Going to talk today about a validation study that that our group did for a mental health referral screen for public assistance clients in New York State. This was, I have no relationships to disclose. I work in the public sector. This was funded by a contract with the New York State Office of Temporary Disability Assistance, which runs our TANF and safety net programs. The New York State Office of Mental Health, which is my employer, and in a sense, not a strict technical sense, but part of my center grant, which was a center to study recovery in social contexts, and that sort of contextualizes our thinking about screening in public assistance or in any environment, which I think, as I thought about, we submitted an abstract for a study we had done. And as I thought about the theme of this year's conference, which is think globally, act locally, I was like, think globally, act locally. This is New York State. Can you get more local? But really I thought, the conceptual framework for this is that it is a local action. It's screening and it's a very individually focused, policy initiative in New York State, and, nationally because it's part of TANF. But in terms of thinking about the context for this sort of screening, I think it's really important that we think about those social factors that impinge on poor women and people who are receiving public assistance. So I just want to, so that's the sense in which it's part of my Center to Study Recovery, and I'll talk about that a little at the end. So why a mental health screen? So I'm going to talk about why a mental health screen and why the MMS, which is the modified mini screen in local social service settings. And then I'll talk about the study itself and then some policy considerations. Well, for one thing, full and diverse community participation is really a human rights principle and a public policy goal, and of course the goal of all of the state agencies that administer these programs and of the feds is to get people to employment and off of public assistance roles. And when you look at the composition of folks receiving public assistance over the last, from 2000 to 2010, what you see is that you've got an increasing proportion of that population has complex conditions. And that, I think, is because that when TANF was initiated in 1996, the initial provision of welfare to work programs really got a lot of those folks who were ready to leave welfare for employment off of the rolls, and so we see an increase in people who have disability, including mental health conditions, but also health-related disabilities continuing to be on the public assistance rolls. I say here that the presence of mental health conditions in local social service departments is around 50%. That's actually, that's kind of if you average the current rates and the lifetime rates. But it's, you want a screen when to help you make decisions when you can't easily make a decision just by knowing the composition of your people. So if it's roughly 50-50, a screen is very helpful in deciding who might need mental health help. And also about 40%, this is from the National NSDUH, National Survey on Drug Use in Households, the SAMHSA survey, which about 40% of people who met criteria for any mental health condition in 2011 did not receive services. So they're still, it's getting better. It used to be over half, slightly over half were not getting services. So we're getting better. But it still means that access to mental health services really needs a push. And this is one place where people can get access, although it's a tricky place. And then there is some evidence for supported approaches to employment, which is really a very good thing. There have been a number of demonstrations within the TANF world across the country to figure out how to get people back to work. What kind of supports do women need? And it's a variety of good programs. They really the results really seem to suggest that you can't have a single focused approach. You can't just focus on people's mental health problems or on their job skills or on their interviewing skills. You really have to have an integrated approach. And you certainly need to pay attention to people's childcare needs, their transportation needs, the realities of their everyday life. In the mental health arena, the specialty mental health system, there is an evidence-based practice, which is supported employment. And the public assistance crowd is starting to take a look at this because it's a really nice integrated way of supporting people, not just to get a job, which is what a lot of the dependent measures in the studies of success for welfare to work programs are. Getting a job, people can't keep the jobs. Supported employment really keeps a person in the work they're doing and supports them as they do that with additional services. So there are some good, there's evidence that people really can be integrated into the workforce somewhat successfully. So these are all good reasons to screen for mental health problems. This is just a look at the data over the last 10 or maybe slightly more years, 15 years of mental health conditions among people who receive public assistance. This is nationwide. First, of course, is the Kessler National Comorbidity Survey, where about a quarter of Americans have a current mental health met criteria for mental health diagnosis in the prior year, about 46% in their lifetime. And my colleague Gary Hogan and I had done we'd actually done a validation of this same, the modified mini-screen. We found about 43% of people in a whole variety of substance use treatment settings, including jails, homeless shelters, street outreach programs, and outpatient residential treatment settings. About 43% of folks had a current condition. Ellen Bassett had focused really on, she focused on single moms and she focused on depression and PTSD. She found, 44%, 35%. Judith Cook's study in Chicago, it's a really good prevalent study of mental health problems among the TANF population. Really nice sampling framework. It's a go-to study if you want to look at this stuff. And she found that 53% of people had a current mental health, a lifetime mental health diagnosis. I want to point out also that it's tricky to screen or evaluate for substance use conditions in a welfare setting because the sanctions, the consequences of a positive response are quite severe. So that's always tricky. You can do it in a study where you can promise confidentiality and not share the results with the agency. But really they're focused on your mental health findings. And then currently I'll just zip down to the last line, which is myself and several of my colleagues, Deborah Lehman, Gary Hoagland, and Dan Tang. And we found in this study that 52% of people had a lifetime mental health diagnosis and 36% had a current mental health diagnosis. So roughly in keeping with this general neck of the woods, we did a skid interview, which is really great validation criterion for mental health condition, but our sampling strategy was not as fabulous as Judith Cook's, so I would still say she's the go-to. She's the go-to lady. And if you included substance use conditions, our lifetime prevalence was, 64%, and current was 38%, and we feel that people were really more willing to disclose lifetime substance use than current substance use, again, because of the environment that we were asking the question in. We did, why the MMS? The modified mini-screen, it really uses the gateway questions to the SCID, to diagnostic criteria. It's like the essential diagnostic criteria. It's 22-item screen. It asks about depression, anxiety, including some specific questions on panic disorder and PTSD, experience of trauma and re-experience of trauma, and then a number of psychosis-related questions. It does exclude substance use. We had validated it, as I said, in a wide variety of chemical dependency settings, and it's quite easy to use in SCORE. It's a yes-no screen. You add up the yeses. It's free, it's in the public domain, and we had developed a computer-assisted interview for the MMS, which we do have available on I'm kind of old, so it's on a CD, but I think we also have it at a link. I'll ask our technical guy if anyone's interested in this. It's in wide use, the MMS, in very wide use in New York State, and we've had many, many requests for use in other states, particularly in chemical dependency settings. But there is no validated screen for mental health conditions in public assistance settings. This is, to our knowledge, the first study to validate a screen for this. And the point of the validation study, in part, is to, let's see, what do I say here? Yeah, part of the validation study, the OTDA, I come from the mental health field and also the chemical dependency field, those folks really know a lot about their people. The Office of Temporary Disability Assistance really had no handle on what the extent of mental health conditions were amongst their population. So they really wanted some information about the people they served from this. And they wanted us to validate the modified mini screen so that they could, you know, take it to policy. And it's had some policy impact, I will say. And then the key thing about our validation of the screen, I always see it this way, is to help the agency and local social service departments develop decision rules. Validation is this rather complex construct. And the sort of very practical policy focused piece that we contribute to, I think, substantially, is to help agencies figure out where, you know, what the trade-offs are when they do a screen. I'll talk a little bit about that. So 5 counties in New York State volunteered to host the study. They had to be participating in a federal grant that OTDA was receiving. The counties who participated included 7 of New York State's 10 largest cities. Hardly ever think about large cities in New York State. It was like New York City and then the rest of the state. New York State is really interestingly diverse, and so we hit these large cities, Yonkers, Mount Vernon, White Plains, Portchester, Rochester, Albany, and Buffalo, and then 6% of New York State is rural, which is, you know, we have the Adirondacks, so there are a number of counties with few people in them. So we tried to pick that up a little bit in Rensselaer County. It was hard to get rural counties to sign on to this. The local social service departments that agreed to participate, we asked them to recruit folks, so they had their local staff become city certified. It was quite an investment of their time and effort in very busy settings to do this study, so they really gave us a lot. We recruited people who were coming to recertify, which happens every 6 months when you're on public assistance. Immediately what happens when people apply for public assistance is that within the first 2 weeks, there's an enormous peel-off. I think people see how draconian it is to be on public assistance, and just don't show. So this is 6 months or farther in. We obtain informed consent from people, and we compensated people, which is why we had such, I think, fabulous retention rates. $25 for the screen and $50 for the diagnostic interview. And the OTDA folks were very surprised that we really got that retention, but. When, you know, the cash was really helpful. So 517 people signed up to do the screen, and 476 came back for the skin interview, which was a telephone interview conducted within 3 weeks, a month. And so it's over 90% retention rate, which we thought was pretty good. The screen consisted of the modified mini screens and background questions, and then we asked the MOS SF-12, the Medical Outcomes Survey, you know, which is a health functioning question, set of questions, and the SCID for DSM was the telephone interview. So most of our study sample, this is based on the folks who completed the PAIR. Most of our study sample were women, and were African American. We did the screen, and we could do the diagnostic interviews in Spanish as well, but we really didn't get a lot of comers for folks whose primary language was Spanish. We had quite a number of people who were bilingual. In the Hispanic sample, 5% were Puerto Rican, 2% were Mexican, and the remainder were of other Hispanic origin. Our sample was based on the, you know, other information about folks who received public assistance. Our sample was pretty highly educated. Almost three quarters of them had completed high school, and that's really pretty substantial. And it was, and I'll explain to you what the mix of this sample was in a minute. So our mean age was 37 years, and that's because 88% of them were parents. And 62%, so well over half, were living with their kids. And the reason that the distribution of characteristics is surprisingly not very young and not well educated is that we had a mix of people who were on family assistance, which is TANF, safety net families, which is folks who have run out of their five-year maximum federal benefit, and then a state safety net kicks in. And then we had safety net individuals, and that is for people who, you know, single people. This was mostly, to characterize them, this is where the men in the study were concentrated. They're men, they were coming out of institutions, typically jail or prison, sometimes, mostly jails or prisons. So they're a pretty disaffiliated group. Some trying to, just get back on their feet. But both those two bottom lines were really state agency folks. So the modified mini itself, it's a solid scale. Its internal consistency, it's maybe a little too internally consistent. These days they're saying, you don't want a Cronbach's alpha in the 90s. You'd like it to be a little less than that because maybe some of your items are redundant. And one of the things we'd like to do is use item response theory, go back and use item response theory to see, what's redundant in this group. But it's really reliable. The test retest was pretty good. It kind of went down on a retest in cases where folks had received the skid in between. And, just the one of our interviewers called the delivering the skid an intervention because it really gave folks an opportunity, a couple of hours, to talk about their troubles. And so they really didn't feel so bad on the retest. Inter-rater reliability is really excellent for this is our skid raters. But if you had a diagnosis, there was perfect reliability that you were going to get picked up on the skid, and the least reliable were depression and PTSD on our validation interview. So the MMS was the screen, the skid was the validation interview, the gold standard. So what did we learn about mental health? Well, I gave you a little peek preview of some of this, but we certainly saw that. I told you that you've had 64% of a lifetime diagnosis and 38% of current diagnosis. The most prevalent, of course, was mood disorders not as it is in the general population. Anxiety disorders were most current. Folks in pretty straitened economic circumstances. Oh, and I should tell you, we ran this study between October 2010 and December 2011. So that's right around when the recession that officially started in December of 2007 was really hitting. This is at the point where unemployment rates are very high. So it's not surprising that people were experiencing some anxiety. Some people in the study met criteria for psychosis. And if we looked at the modified mini items, you did have people with thought disorders, very few people with paranoid types of symptoms verified. So mental health diagnosis really impacted people's functioning. I told you we did in the SCID, we did the global assessment of functioning, and you can see that people with a mental health diagnosis really were on the level of having moderate symptoms, moderate difficulty in school, occupational, family relationships. They were not doing so well. Folks without a current diagnosis, they were having some struggles but they're the normal everyday struggles of life and life at the margins. People's physical health and mental health scores, these are on the MOS, so that is standardized to a mean of 50 with a standard deviation of 10. So you see the people with a mental health diagnosis are about a standard deviation below the general population in their physical health and almost two standard deviations below the general population in their mental health functioning. People without are not so great, especially in their physical health, but they're close to the norm. In terms of being unable to carry out their usual activities, in the general population, we kind of did a little. We looked at Kathleen Merikangas' data on what that disability was, and it worked out to about 3 days a year for the general population. So you can see that for both those with no current diagnosis and those with a diagnosis, certainly, they were not so able to carry out their usual activities. And were in bed or had an illness for quite a number of days. People are really not able to participate fully in their communities or even in their families to a certain extent. This is by case type, so what you'll see here, and it's an unfortunate organization of the slide. I think I wish I'd put the SNI column on the far right. Because the family assistance and the safety net families are pretty similar to each other. But the people with the safety net individuals who I described to you earlier as being rather disaffiliated, they're really quite different. They're statistically different. Their MMS scores are higher. Their global assessment of functioning scores are lower. I'm sorry, you know, I changed the master slide, you know, and I didn't go back and make that black. Those two. Functioning is days per year, right? And that GAF score for the safety net families is 69.7, and for the total it's 68.3. So you can see that the safety net individuals are really in poor shape. Also in their physical health, not so much in their mental health. They're about similar. That was the only place where they were not different. More days unable to carry out activities and more days in bed. So we learned about mental health that, as I said, about a third of the sample, 36%, met criteria for current condition, over 60% for a lifetime any condition, and a little under 60% for a lifetime actual mental health condition. Everyone reported lower levels of functioning than the general population. But those with a mental health condition reported both poor health and functioning than those with no mental health condition. And safety net individuals and older participants, reported poor health and functioning. You know, the younger participants, their vitality was very high. They were like on target with the general population. People under 30 were on target with the general population in terms of their vitality dimension on the MOS. Mood disorders were most common. Anxiety disorders in the past month were the most common. And 55% of our sample had experienced a traumatic event in their lifetime. 13% met current criteria for PTSD. And again, I mean, this is a sample of particularly young women, but people who over time have silted up on the degree of social dysfunction that they've been existing in and are the effect of. So when we reported this to policy folks for action, that was something we felt really needed to be taken into account, paying attention to community violence, intimate partner violence, and experiences of abuse. And we looked then at the treatment gap, and what we found was that in New York State, those with a current mental health condition, about 44% of people were not receiving current mental health treatment. It's about this, it's actually a little worse than the, In the NSDUH shows us that about 40% of people with any mental health condition are receiving treatment. We've got about 60% receiving treatment, so we're a little better resourced in that sense. But still, that's a pretty big number of people who aren't receiving treatment who are currently in distress. So, that's a key piece to what we reported to the state agency, who said, well, what about, you know, we're going to screen these folks and then we are obligated to provide them with some services, and our local mental health setting, not so much. What are we going to do? So this is just we analyzed the data using a receiver operating characteristics curve. And what this does is this takes the sensitivity and the specificity, which, as many of you probably know, is the rates of true positives and true negatives in the study. And this takes them for every point on the screen and splays them out in a single picture. ROC curves were developed in World War II. It's really a ratio of signal to noise, and it was developed so people could tell whether a bomber was coming. A bomber was coming or not. Well, in any event, a good ROC, a perfect ROC curve would have the that black line is our total population. Right? Would have that going perfectly vertically up and then perfectly horizontally across. You know, go all the way up at perfectly no false positives and then perfectly across at all true positives, right? But that, of course, isn't going to happen. The chance reference point is that horizontal red line. That's 50-50. That's flip a coin. Do as well as just guessing. So the MMS gets you up in that 0.85 of accuracy, which is pretty good, especially given that these are fuzzy questions, fuzzy conditions. So it's really quite good. An excellent screen would usually give you an area under the curve of about 0.9, and this gives a 0.85. So pretty good. And you can see there that the safety net individuals that's that yellow line. It performs less well for them, but really quite well for the family assistants, the Tanner folks, and the safety net families, pretty well. So Otada said to us, well, as I said, you know, what about the shortage of services? So you know, here's your trade-offs. If you pick a screen, the lower your cut point on a screen, the more people come through the screen. So if you pick a cut point of 7, you're gonna identify, you know, 93% of, you know, of people who have a condition. But you're also gonna get a lot of people who don't. And as you go up the line, if you pick a cut point of 9, you will, you know, you'll miss some people. You'll only identify 80% of people who truly have a condition. But you'll get fewer false positives. So these are your trade-offs. Take your choice. So that's what they've done. They've taken this to local social service departments, and they're allowing the local departments, based on their mental health treatment capacity, to decide where they want to set the cut points. And the screen really performs pretty comparably across these three cutoff points. So it's a reliable and accurate screen. The best place is between 7 and 9. Set-based decision rules on local capacity. And because these are coercive settings, first of all, we wanted the screens to be optional for localities because they do have obligations once they identify people with conditions. And then we feel that within the locality that the screens should be optional for individuals. Advocates, welfare advocates, are very much pushing for having a mental health screen. They currently have New York City it's called HRA in New York City, but New York City Welfare Department, in court pushing for the MMS, actually, as a screen to identify people with optional, and that's the crux of the issue in the implementation of the screen, is whether once you screen positive and are sent for an assessment, you know, are you sanctioned then for not complying with those recommendations? That's the nub, the political nub. And this is really human rights implications. This is the think globally, act locally. I do think of mental health services as a human rights effort. And I think that really what has to change is the social and cultural environment in a big way for people. This is a kind of a graph of Amartya Sen's capabilities framework. And you really have to change personal capacity, the resources people have access to, and law, policy, and regulation so that people have an opportunity to choose what they actually want to do and be. And I think that while the screen focuses on personal capacity, matching personal capacity, resources, and commodities, mental health treatment, I really think we need to look at the social context that these women especially, live their lives in, and that it's really not just about the mental health condition. It's really about the poverty and the cumulative stress and the exposure to violence that women live with. So I think that's really important to keep in mind as we move forward. It's not an individual failing. It's really a global issue. Thank you.